Hey everyone, Chet Cemetery is back. I'm your host, Deanna Chapman, and today I am joined by Brad C. Hodson, and we are discussing the 2016 adaptation Cell, which is a movie that I don't think either myself or Brad would like to watch again. Brad, how are you doing today?
Not too bad, and you're definitely right about that. I can't imagine sitting through this film again, but thanks for having me on to talk about why.
Yeah, of course. And full disclosure here, we're recording this one a few months in advance, specifically because I did not want to have to rewatch it down the line, because a few months ago, I did a guest appearance on the podcast, I Hope You Suffer, to discuss this movie as well. They wanted to talk about a bad Stephen King movie. They weren't doing a whole month of Stephen King movies this year, but check out I Hope You Suffer if you haven't. I'll have a link to my episode appearance in the show notes. But Brad, you know, given the cast, you would think Cell would have been a better movie.
Yeah, completely. Not only is it a fantastic cast, but Cusack and Jackson teamed up for an adaptation of King's work that I really like, which is 1408. And I thought they were both fantastic in that and not so much in this.
Yeah. 1408, hands down a better adaptation.
Yeah. I'm still kind of in shock, I think, watching this. And it's weird. I'm a fan of bad movies. I love watching bad movies because oftentimes they're funny. Everyone involved will swing for the fences. In that way, I always say what's enjoyable about bad movies is that all good movies are good in the same handful of ways. Bad movies are bad in an infinite number of variants. There's kind of a joy in watching somebody try really hard, and I'm not going to say fail because it's not a cruelty thing, but there's a joy in watching somebody try something so weird and different, and when it doesn't work, it's hilarious without even having to like denigrate the work. Like, I legitimately love bad movies. Cell, however, is not, there's nothing fun or enjoyable in this film. It's just a grim slog of mediocrity. Like, I hate to be cruel, but I really feel like there was no, I don't feel that anyone involved behind the scenes was actually passionate about doing the project. I'll say that. That's probably the most apt feeling I had walking away from it.
Right. And this was directed by Todd Williams. You have John Cusack as Clay, Samuel L. Jackson as Tom. And there are two major characters, along with Isabel Furman as Alice, Owen Teague as Jordan. You even have a Stacy Keach appearance, and he's playing the headmaster. And based on the book, which albeit wasn't my favorite story of King's either. So I kind of went into this being like, well, I didn't really care for the book that much. And there were a lot of strange things that he did in the book. But one thing I want to give the book credit for is that it kind of makes you care about these characters. Whereas I don't feel like the movie really hit you with that same kind of emotion, you know. I actually missed the entire scene where Alice died. And I was like, wait, where'd she go? And I had to go back. And I was like, oh, but you didn't really feel all that much about that scene.
Yeah. Okay. So that makes me feel a lot better because I missed it too. And I had a moment where I was like, oh man, I'm going to be on this podcast. And I let myself get distracted. I wasn't paying attention to this movie, but now I feel a lot better about missing that scene. Cause it was just kind of like, you're in the scene and things are happening. And then it's like, wait, she died? What?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I haven't read the book. It's one that I always wanted to read and never got around to. And so when I first heard that they were making an adaptation, I was like, oh, great. Well, you know, when that comes out, I'll have to read the book and then check out the movie. And then the adaptation just kind of went to development hell. I think I first remember hearing about it around 2006. Eli Roth was going to direct it.
Which is when the book came out, if I'm not mistaken. It was the book in 2006, and then this didn't end up coming out until 2016.
Yeah. And apparently there was a lot of the reason Roth dropped off the project is the studio wanted to do something very different with it. And he was just like, well, fine, that's not the movie I want to make. And I don't know what those ideas were, how much made it into the finished product. But again, it was 10 years later when the movie came out, and came out unceremoniously.
Yeah.
I think it went straight to streaming, didn't it? In 2016?
It might have had a very limited theatrical release. I'm not 100% sure on that, but, you know, it came out a year after this, and I had no recollection of this coming out. Granted, I hadn't started this podcast yet. I hadn't really started diving into King in the same way that I did for this podcast, but I had seen The Shining, I had seen Carrie, you know, I had seen a lot of the big movies, and I knew that it was coming out. And to have this just totally fly under the radar was very odd. Granted, it's not one of King's most well-known stories or books, and you would just think, given the cast, it would be, you know, something that's on the radar a little more.
Given the cast, given the fact that it's a twist on zombies, which, especially in 2016, like, zombies were huge, there was just so much. It was obvious that nobody really had any faith in the project.
Yeah, and it did go to VOD June 10th, 2016, and then there had been a very, very limited theatrical release in July, and it made a whole $1 million at the box office.
Yeah, it's probably more than it deserved. I just, again, I hate to be mean. Like, being involved in the film industry, I know the ridiculous amount of just backbreaking work that goes into even the worst movie. And nobody sets out to make a bad movie.
No, of course not.
Never anyone's intention. Like I said, I don't feel that anyone involved in this cared, had any passion about it. You don't feel any moments where someone's really trying to do anything with the work. It felt like from top to bottom, directors, actors, everyone involved, it was just a paycheck. When you can feel that in a movie, then it's really gone south. And especially, you know, again, you're talking the cast, 2016, Sam Jackson, who's, you know, one of the cornerstones of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, the highest grossing franchise of all time. That movie should have been everywhere. Even if, you know, the reviews ended up bad and it flopped, like, there still should have been a big advertising push, big promotional push. Yeah, you could just tell that even the studio people had zero faith in this film.
Which is crazy, because you would think that Samuel L. Jackson and John Cusack alone would be able to propel a movie forward, even if, like you said, it is bad. You would think it'd still get butts in the seats at the theaters at this time.
Yeah, I think there were a combination of things. One, the look of the film, it was a very ugly looking movie. It did not feel like a cinematic experience. It didn't feel like nothing about the look of the film looked the way that a movie with John Cusack and Sam Jackson should be in. It looked very much like a low budget independent feature shot by kids in their 20s in Pittsburgh on summer break.
It looks like a movie I would make, not knowing anything.
Yeah, it's like, and maybe that's a part of it too. I wasn't really thinking about this while watching it, but reflecting back on it, that cheapness, I wonder if there was a big slash in the budget, you know, and maybe that kind of killed everyone's enthusiasm for the project, you know, because you're talking this big, epic, post-apocalyptic story. I never felt the scope of it. I never felt that this was happening everywhere. I never even felt that this was happening all over the state. I felt that it was just like groups of people, even though they talk about how it's the global apocalypse when it occurs. And I guess, you know, we're kind of talking around it, but for anyone who's not familiar with it, the whole premise is that there's a signal that goes out simultaneously on cell phones across the United States that basically turns people into zombies. They become very similar in the film, at least, to the rage zombies of 28 Days Later.
Right. As someone who hasn't watched a ton of zombie movies or TV shows, it almost felt like this really wanted to be King's Walking Dead, and it just didn't live up to either aspect that he's really good at, which Stephen King is really great at creating these monsters that people fear, and he's really great at writing characters. And you don't get either of those things really in the adaptation, because you feel like a lot of this is just happening mindlessly.
Yeah. There were a lot of moments that made me feel like there was a bigger scene that either was written or shot, and for whatever reason, we're only seeing the moments that propel the plot. And like you said, I think that does a disservice to King. Like King works best in the areas where he can breathe. Yeah, he comes up with scary ideas and, you know, can have great plots and great stories. But even in the books where the ideas end up being a little silly, or the plot's not really engrossing, like the characters always are. And I didn't have a sense of who any of these people were by the end of the movie.
Exactly. And even though I didn't like the book all that much, like I said, he at least did something interesting with the characters. Like with Alice, for instance, she has this traumatic thing happen at the beginning of the story, which, you know, there's a lot of differences from the book, but her having to kill her mother is the same. It just happens in a slightly different location and context. But in the book, he dives much deeper into her trauma from having to do that. And here it's just like she kind of exists, but nothing really happens, you know, emotionally with her character.
Yeah. And even Cusack, the main character, and I'm sorry, what was his character's name? Clay? Is that right?
Yes.
So Clay, we meet him, and he's on the phone with his wife or ex-wife. I never quite got the sense if they were separated or divorced. And his kid, when his phone dies, and he has to get back on the phone. So we get this kind of like hint of a character development that, oh, he's, you know, obviously having some kind of family problems and he's conflicted and yada yada. And then it doesn't really go anywhere. It's almost like it exists, that exists solely to set up the plot point later.
Yep.
Where he has come back to his house and then lead us to the ending. But like, we never deal with what that means for him. How does the guilt or the shame or any kind of emotion, like we never deal with it. And then when we get to his apartment and find out that he draws a graphic novel that I think he also writes, it's just such like a quick throwaway thing. He's got all these drawings up on the wall and Sam Jackson's like, what are these? And he's like, oh, I do a graphic novel. And then it just cuts to the next scene. And again, it felt like such a throwaway thing that I was like, oh, that's just his job, right? But right. Then it becomes like a huge point later in the movie that he did that. And it's like, well, why didn't we get to learn a little bit about the graphic novel while we're looking at the freaking graphic novel?
Yeah, obviously in the book you can't visually see those things, but there was like a whole sort of thing at the beginning there where there was more about him getting a deal for his graphic novel, which is basically mentioned in passing, I think, on the phone with his wife, who I do think they are at least separated, but it was hard to tell if they were divorced or not, like you said. And it was just mentioned in passing, whereas that is such a big part of him.
Yeah, and it's mentioned in such a weird way in passing.
Yeah.
That I didn't even realize that's what he did. I thought he was like a software developer, the way he's talking about it. He says something like, oh yeah, you know, I got this, you know, I landed this great gig. And then he mentions algorithms or something. And I was like, oh, I guess he's a software developer.
Yeah.
Like, having not read the book, I had no clue who this guy was. And then the same thing happens again when we meet Sam Jackson. He drives a train for a living. That is the only thing I know about him by the end of the movie.
Yeah, that was all I got out of it pretty much too, which is unfortunate because this movie could have been so much more interesting with, you know, a little more effort put into the character work.
Yeah. And then meanwhile, while we're following these kind of surfacey characters that we don't learn anything about, we're heading through this bleak autumn landscape of some kind of industrial city. Like when we open, we're at an airport, but then suddenly it looks like we're in, like, I don't know, downtown Gary, Indiana for the rest of the movie. And everything's just brick and concrete and dead trees. which you could still do something with, but there's just nothing visually interesting while we're following these characters that we don't care about. And so it's just, it's really hard to engage with the film in any way.
Yeah, this was one where I had it on and I kept not wanting to watch it, to be honest. And like we both said, we both missed Alice's death, which means at that point in the movie, we both probably got so bored that we were just like, okay, come on, can this hurry up? And we, like, you know, looked at our phones or something.
Yeah. And also during scenes like that, I kept thinking I had a problem with my television and was messing with my brightness. Everything was so dark that I couldn't tell what was going on. And, you know, I'm a fan of nice, dark, legitimately shot at night scenes, but I still have to, if you have a lot of action and things happening in those dark spaces, I have to be able to tell what's happening. And just a lot of times it was just like black with movement was all I could see. And that's especially true. There was so much where it was obvious, especially in the climax, that it was shot probably on a soundstage, and they did a kind of a bad day for night, and a lot of, I don't know, kind of video game looking backgrounds that they put all the zombies against. Mm-hmm. There was nothing aside from the ideas of the story that I enjoyed about it. You know, the ideas that King brought, like the signal from the cell phone, what's behind that, the fact that just like they have a hive mind and, you know, hordes of people opening their mouths at once and hearing this electronic signal come out. Like those things were, they were good ideas, but they weren't executed in a way that kept me interested.
And the production value just kind of distracted you from a lot of what you were watching too, because the scenes where they're just walking down the road and whatnot, it's so bleak, not just story-wise, but the way it looks, it's like, it almost looks like it wasn't even filmed in HD.
Yeah, it's just a very ugly-looking movie. And I don't know. I mean, again, we've seen so many zombie things. They all kind of play in that area. You know, Walking Dead did that a lot. Walking Dead found, in its early seasons, before I checked out on it, they always found like industrial areas and things to film. You know, it would just be like an ugly brick warehouse with like train tracks running alongside it. But they made it visually interesting in the scene. And in this, they go the other way. It's just, it's very flat and ugly and shot just very straightforward. And there's just nothing that keeps your eye on the screen. It's, yeah, this movie.
I think the only memorable scene, for me at least, was when they had the zombies sleeping on the football field and Tom and Clay get in that truck and drive over the bodies. That's like the only visual element that really stood out to me. And it's happening at night, though, so it's pretty dark and you can't really see all that much of it. But I thought that was at least interesting, and it was like, oh, they're doing this thing, and it kind of gets your attention again. But for the most part, a lot of the characters just also didn't have anything to do most of the time. Like in the book, Jordan is much more helpful, even though he's a kid. You do get glimpses of that here and there in the movie, but it felt like they just let everyone else take the back seat to John Cusack and Samuel L. Jackson, which makes sense, but if you want to be a little more true to the source material, Alice and Jordan have to be a much bigger part of this.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought when they introduced Jordan, I was like, oh, here we go. One of my favorite character dynamics that King revisits over and over again is the surrogate parent. You know, you've got in Salem's Lot, you've got Ben Mears and Mark Petrie, for instance. Love those relationships. And he comes back and he does that a lot in his work. And he always does it in a different way. And it always captivates me. It's always a great dynamic. And I was like, oh, great. That's what we're going to get here with Clay and Jordan. And then nothing. It just never went anywhere.
Yeah. And I don't want to give away the ending of the book for you by any means, but there's a very different feeling at the end of the book than the one you get here. And here in the movie, I was just like, okay, I don't really care.
Yeah, and it was an interesting idea. Spoiler alert. Clay's trying to find his son, who's gone to this place that is supposed to be a safe place, but everyone else thinks is probably a trap by whatever is behind the signal to get people who aren't infected to go there. And so Clay's going to go anyway. So he drives this truck full of C4 out and pulls up, and there's just hordes and hordes of zombies just circling this cell phone tower in the middle of nowhere. And his son's there, and he comes up and he sees his son and he hugs his son. And then he hits the button on the cell phone he has with him, and it blows up the van of C4 and blows up the tower. And then it cuts to him and his son walking along a trail, trying to meet back up with the other survivors. And his son's fine, except that's actually going on in his head, because he's now been infected by the signal and is just walking around in a circle with the other zombies around the tower. And that could have been a very, very interesting ending. You know, there's a way that I think you could do that twist where you spend a little bit of time and you're like, oh, we had a happy ending. And then it's like, no, you pull the rug out from under everyone. It was in his head. He's infected. And the idea that like everybody who's infected has something similar going on in their heads. And, you know, just this kind of, it almost becomes like, it could become like almost like a Matrix type moment, you know, where it's like, oh gosh, what is reality if everybody's living in their heads, et cetera, et cetera, and really yank that out from under you. Or make it ambiguous, like, is this really happening, or did he get infected? Like, there's a lot of interesting ways you can do it. And they blow through it so fast and so surfacey that by the time you get to the credits, you're like, well, what the hell did I even set through the movie for if that was the ending?
Yeah. And it felt really long, too.
Yeah, it was only an hour and 20-minute movie, I think. And it feels like you're watching a three-hour film.
Which is not good.
Not at all. Especially, again, just how ugly the film is. It's like, I feel like I'm sitting here all day just looking at all this ugliness.
I think it was actually a little over an hour and a half, maybe closer to an hour 40, which explains why it felt even longer.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I watched this roughly a week or two ago, and I'm sitting here and I'm like, what happened?
Yeah. And, you know, I didn't read a lot on the development of the movie before I went into it, because I just kind of wanted to go in fresh, and I knew the critics had panned it, and I was like, all right, I don't want to taint my perception by reading too much. But one thing I did come across is that Stephen King wrote the ending, because he said he felt a lot of people didn't like the ending in the book. He's credited as one of the screenwriters, but I wonder how much involvement he actually had and at what point he wrote that. It feels to me like there was probably a script that King was involved in when Eli Roth was developing the film. And when that fell apart, they rewrote the script and, you know, just kind of changed a lot about what they were doing on the film. And I could be completely wrong, but it doesn't feel like King's involvement continued. And maybe they took an element here or there that he had brought to the script, but none of it, even his worst made-for-TV movies, you couldn't feel any of the King in this script. I can't imagine a lot of what he did made it onto the screen.
When I saw that he was credited with the screenplay, and obviously, you know, he wasn't the only one credited with the screenplay, but I was just like, huh, this did not turn out how I expected it to, given that he wrote it, or at least some of it.
And it may have been a case, too. Like I said earlier, I felt like a lot of scenes, we jumped into it at a weird moment and cut out of it at a weird moment. So it may be that there's actually a really good screenplay behind this movie, and that it was just directed so flatly and then edited to hell that we're left with just having to guess about that. Because I think that's one of the things that makes it a not enjoyable bad movie, is the fact that there's no particular problem with the screenplay, aside from the character elements that we talked about. But like, there's no hokey dialogue. There's no ridiculously stupid turn in the middle. There's no moment that makes you set up and go, what? And laugh at it.
There's no maximum overdrive element to this movie.
Yeah. So I feel like there might have been a good script, but even if there wasn't, it's at least a competent one, and that most of the failures happen in the execution. But I could be wrong. Maybe this is exactly how the script was written and there's zero character development in the script. I can't imagine that. I can't imagine how anyone would read something of King to adapt and neglect the character development, especially when the plot itself is so simple. You know, it's not like there's a lot of complex plotting that you need to get to. It's just move from point A to point B and get attacked by zombies and run, and then move from point C to D and then get attacked by zombies and run. You know, it's basically the whole movie.
Seeing this adaptation makes me very worried about The Long Walk.
Yeah, the one thing with that, though, is have you watched a lot of Edgar Wright films?
I have seen a few, but I wouldn't say I know a bunch of his work super well.
Yeah, he's I think Edgar Wright's a really talented filmmaker. And, you know, he's probably most people listening to this would probably have seen Shaun of the Dead. But, you know, he did that whole trilogy of movies. Hot Fuzz is my favorite in there, you know, with Simon Pegg and Nick Frost. And then he did Baby Driver.
That I have seen, yes. And Ant-Man, because
yeah,
I watch all of the superhero movies.
Yeah, very key on Ant-Man. And I never saw Scott Pilgrim versus the World, but I know, you know, everybody I know seems to love that movie. So I think he at least, and Edgar Wright kind of, he has like a style, you know, he brings like some energy and, so even if The Long Walk's not great, it will at least feel like a movie.
That's always a plus.
Yeah, compared to this, which doesn't. You know, and it's funny, last time we talked, or no, it was the time before that, was the 2004 TV adaptation of Salem's Lot.
Ah, yes.
And just talking about how cheap and ugly this movie looks, Sal, and how I don't feel any passion for it. I feel like we were very negative about that Salem's Lot adaptation, and I would say that it's light years ahead of this. Like,
agreed.
That they probably had less money for Salem's Lot, and you know, there's all the problems that we had talked about, but I at least felt like the people involved in that movie cared. You know, they were trying to make a good movie, and I just do not get that with Sal.
I agree, and I don't have a ton to say about this movie because not a whole lot happens, and that is very unfortunate. But Brad, do you have anything else before we wrap up here?
No, not really. It is unfortunate. I feel like we just kind of retreaded the same ground over and over, but there's nothing to talk about. Like I said, it's bad.
And the fact that we haven't even mentioned Denise and Ray tells you.
Oh, yeah.
How little of an impact they have, even though, you know, Ray goes and blows himself up. And it's just like, oh, okay, he went crazy. And that's kind of where they leave that at. And yeah, a lot of this just did not work for me.
I didn't even know Denise's name until you just said it.
Denise. That's what it was in the book.
No, it probably was. And her character is so minuscule in the movie that she made no impression on me whatsoever. And that's kind of the movie as a whole. I think that kind of sums it up, is it's bad in the most mediocre of ways.
Yep. It's a bad, bad movie, not a bad, fun movie.
Yeah. And it makes me want to watch Maximum Overdrive.
Yeah. Which is wild to say.
Yeah.
This movie was so bad, we would rather watch a different bad movie.
Yeah. Or Rose Red or something.
Well, to quickly wrap up with ratings here, I gave this a 1 out of 5, which kind of seemed generous now that I think about it.
Yeah. Yeah, I would too. And I almost never do that. Even movies I usually dislike,
yeah,
there's something that makes me be like, well, it's 2 stars.
Uh-huh. Same.
I liked this one scene, or I appreciate what they were trying to do. But yeah, just nothing here.
Yeah, this is about an hour and a half of our life that we will never get back. I am so sorry.
Well, at least my curiosity was satisfied. I'd been wondering about this movie, and now I know.
See, I at least read the book first, and knowing that I didn't care for the book as much, but I still knew what could be accomplished with an adaptation having read it, I feel like you have the opposite viewpoint now, to where you're going from something that's so bad, you can only imagine the book's better.
Yeah. Yeah. It actually does make me want to read the book just to compare. But it is interesting talking about it in that respect, in that there were a lot of things that you, having read the book, were disappointed that they didn't do with the characters. And to me, coming in fresh and just feeling like the characters were nothing on the screen, it's like, oh, well, that makes sense that they existed in a better form in the book. But, you know.
Yeah.
But, like, I had no context for anything in the movie. I think that's why I kept being confused. Like I said, I thought that character was a software developer until they got to his apartment and saw his drawings. It's just, yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely a don't watch this unless you really want to complete every Stephen King adaptation, which even I haven't done. You know, I gave up on the Children of the Corn movies after the third one.
Yeah. I can't blame you for that. I think you made it better than I did.
I feel like most people don't, so that's why I let it slide. I was like, you know what? Maybe one day I will circle back to them, but I don't know anyone who has watched all 11 of them, I believe there are now. But
11 of them?
Yeah. Yeah. It's so many.
Now I kind of feel like I have to watch them just as a challenge.
Well, if anyone is going to take on that challenge, please let me know, because I would like to be entertained by that. And, you know, Cell, not one I think either of us would recommend, but we watched it. It is done. It is over with. I have somehow done two podcasts on it now, and I think I'm good.
You can never talk about Cell again the rest of your life and be fine.
Perfect. Until someone redoes it in 20 years.
Yeah.
Well, Brad, thank you so much. And you will definitely be back on. I know we have some Patreon exclusive episodes that you'll be doing as well. So thank you again. And I'm sorry.
Oh, no sweat. I always have fun at least talking about these things, even if they're not fun to watch.
Same. All right, that does it for this episode of Chat Cemetery. You can support the podcast on Patreon for $1 a month. You'll get a thank you on the show. For $2 a month, I will send you a Chat Cemetery sticker. And if you want to follow us on social media, you can do so at Chat Cemetery on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You could also rate and review the show. That's a huge help. And as always, thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoy the rest of your day.